new recording from Michelle Pilar, and You Untangle Me, the name of the song. It is 11 minutes after the hour on a winsome Wednesday morning here along the broken road. And I almost said on the you're not really on the line, though, but he's here virtually with us. Doug Greenwald, Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director of Preserving Bible Times, coming to us from Columbia, Maryland. Nobody says on the line anymore unless they're fishing, maybe, huh?
Well, yeah, and it's springtime, at least here in Columbia. Mm-hmm. Has spring come to East Dakota yet? Have you seen a crocus?
Well, I don't know, little pointy things that grow out of the ground? Yeah, we got a few of those around, and then they got snowed on Monday. We got about 2-3 inches of snow, and today it's going to be back in the 60s and sunshine, and who knows what it's going to do tomorrow.
So we've had some wild daffodils that were growing up in the neighbor's yard.
Wild daffodils?
Yeah, they just, well, volunteers. They just kind of, I'm not sure how they got there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well.
So are the ice fishing tournaments over now then?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, this was an early ice out here on the lakes. They were, there was no ice on the lakes by mid-April, even a little earlier than that, like 10th, 11th, 12th of April. So I've never seen it that early in 30 years here. So it must be, is it global warming, David, you suppose?
I think so. Okay. I think it is.
All right.
There's a new global warming movie coming out.
Is there?
It's just something you can look forward to. Yeah, it'll be this summer.
It's going to convince
Al Gore probably had time in his hands. I don't know.
Directed by Mr. Al Gore. Wow, okay.
All right. It could be. Yeah. I'm not sure, but I saw the trailers for it yesterday.
Okay.
Yeah, something we can look forward to.
Trailers, that's something we know about here at East Dakota. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Doug, we spent not nearly enough time on Passion Week. I mean, there were so many things happening and so many things we didn't get to. But one of the most momentous or the most pivotal things, I think, was the change that it afforded in this guy named Peter. Peter was just a plain old fisherman type when now, he was from, Bethsaida, right? Which would be the northeast corner of Galilee, that community up in that direction. But his business was in Capernaum, and he was in business with his brother and also with James and John and Zebedee. Was he a known quantity to Jesus, do you suppose, when Jesus first called him? Was it maybe old friends, childhood friends? Could that have been?
I would think that would be pretty hard to come by. Mm-hmm. Jesus has been in Nazareth until 30 years of age. Far as we know, Simon Peter might have grown up in Bethsaida.
Yeah.
But that part of the Sea of Galilee, that quadrant, was rapidly changing from observant Judaism to Hellenistic Judaism, which would have forced the observant Jews to leave, which is why I think we see that Simon has crossed over the Jordan River Inlet, which is at the north end, the center north end of the Sea of Galilee, and is now to be found in Capernaum. Mm-hmm. We know Jesus set up his Galilean ministry based in Capernaum, but all of that would suggest to me maybe after around age 30, they started to develop a passing acquaintance of one another, but probably not before.
Mm-hmm. So what would Jesus have seen in Peter? Now, I have trouble trying to see things through Jesus' eyes. He has some advantages over me. But he surrounded himself with people he was acquainted with. I mean, John, a cousin, perhaps, and people he maybe had known lifelong time, but then maybe not Peter. So was it fair to say a supernatural understanding, an instinctive understanding of who Peter was, and that he would use him in such a powerful way?
Yeah, we can't fully fathom what it means for Jesus to be fully divine and yet fully human at the same time. So how much foreknowledge he would have had and how much penetrating insight he would have had into Simon Peter is just one of speculation. But I do think Simon had the perfect name for what Jesus wanted to do with people, with maybe Simon being Exhibit A. Simon, from a root word meaning perspective in the Semitic world, means pebble. And Peter, Cephas, means rock. And so Jesus and the particular case of Simon Peter is going to take this pebble fisherman and make him into a rock of the kingdom. And in that sense, he is represents what Jesus does with almost all of us. Takes very, very ordinary people, and empowered by his Spirit, enables extraordinary things to happen in the kingdom of God. So for me, Simon Peter, or Peter, is like exhibit A of where Jesus starts with people and where he ends up with people. Anyway, when we first meet Simon Peter, it's on the pages of Luke's gospel in the fifth chapter, because he's a fisherman, as you've mentioned, and he fished all night and he caught nothing. And that leads to his encounter with Jesus and the great catch of fish, and Jesus' call for them to be fishers of men. And so very early on, we are part of Simon Peter's life as he makes the transition to be a disciple of Jesus. The reason I think it's important to remember how it started is because that's how it ends. And that gets a little bit ahead of our storyline today. But we're going to find him back on that same beach. We're going to find that he fished again all night and caught nothing. And it's like that motif bookends his encounters with Jesus. But anyway, let's go back to Luke. He gets called. And so he starts walking with Jesus every day as a disciple. And as we observed many, many times before, encounters shock therapy every day, one day after another, as Jesus does, which from Peter's initial perspective would have to be totally outrageous things. He touches lepers. He heals and forgives paralytics. He calls a despised pork tax collector to come into his band. He heals the withered right hand of a man on the Sabbath. And on and on and on it goes. And so this is where we pick up our motif that being in training as a disciple of Jesus really means you are exposed to one shock therapy experience after another, day after day, because that is Jesus' way of making disciples. And to make them, you first have to sort of detox them from everything that their religious culture has done to them. And that's why Jesus is subjecting these 12.
So he's contrasting what the kingdom of God is like with the kingdom, with the theocracy that they're living in at the time. These are all examples of what his kingdom is supposed to be.
It's one huge compare and contrast. Mm-hmm. This is what they've told you. This is what I'm going to say for you. You have heard it said, but I say unto you. You know that Gentiles are to be despised, and I want to tell you that God loves them. I mean, on and on and on and on it goes. Until finally, post-Pentecost, they actually get it, and everything comes together. But anyway, that gets way ahead of our story. So maybe, roughly speaking, we're halfway through that three-year earthly experience of Jesus and his disciples. And Matthew, in the 16th chapter, tells us about an encounter that Jesus had up in the district of Caesarea Philippi, starting in 16:13, when Jesus came to the area of Caesarea Philippi. They would never walk into that city because it's totally a hedonistic Gentile city, but they're up in that region. Jesus asked his disciples, "Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" And they answered, and some say John the Baptist, others Elijah, others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. But he said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" And Simon Peter, so that's how he's referred to here, as a mix of pebble rock. Simon Peter answered, "You are the Christ, the Christos, the Son of the living God." And Jesus answered him, "You are blessed, Simon, son of Jonah, because flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father in heaven. And I tell you that you are Peter, Cephas, and on this rock." They are in the foothills of Mount Hermon, 9,200 foot tall mountain in the northern part of this land. And there was a huge opening, like the front end of a cave, in a certain part of these foothills, which is where Caesarea Philippi was built around. The Romans considered that to be the entrance to Hades. And so Jesus then builds on that image. And I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overpower it. Now here's where I want to focus. Matthew 16:19. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will have been bound in heaven, and whatever you release on earth will have been released in heaven. Okay, binding and loosing is what rabbis do in this intensely observant Judaism culture, this intensely religious culture. Bind means if I say something, you're bound by it for the rest of the days of your life. Loose means if you come to me and ask to be let loose from what I have just bound you from, I may or may not do it. But if I do do it, you are released. You are loosed from that decree. Binding and loosing is what rabbis do in this culture. And this is where Jesus says, Simon Peter, you're going to become Peter, and you are going to be the successor rabbi to the band. Okay? This is where Simon Peter gets ordained, if you will, to be the rabbi in training. Ever wonder why Peter is so prominent in early Acts? It goes all the way back to here, because Jesus said, you're going to be the leader of the band. But we got a slight problem between then and now, because he keeps messing up. And we're familiar with a lot of those. But let's go forward then a little bit to the Upper Room Discourse. We're in the Essene Quarter of Jerusalem, most likely because Jesus is familiar with the Essene Quarter because his cousin John the Baptist, most feel, was raised by the Essene community. He wants to get away a little bit from the heat of the religious establishment, and he can do that in the Essene Quarter. So they're having what we call the Last Supper. And in the midst of that, they're doing this around a triclinium table, three-sided table that you recline at, hence triclinium to recline. There's a complete seating protocol that was discovered, was written in a Jewish play in the 2nd century in Alexandria, Egypt, that tells us what the seating protocol is around this three-sided table. On side one, which is the most important side, is where the most important people will sit, starting with seat one, which is where the host sits, then seat two, which is where the guest of honor sits, and then seat three, where the guest of the guest of honor sits. And then you have the middle side, that's where the intermediately important people sit. And then you have the third side, which is where the least important people sit. And the last seat on the third side, which would be the least important seat on the least important side, is known as the servant seat. And when we put together the seating protocol, the seating diagram, from the pieces of information that were given in the Gospels, John is in the first seat, the host seat. Jesus is in the guest of honor seat. Jesus has selected Judas Iscariot to be his guest of honor in seat three. And all the way down in seat 12 is Simon Peter. Because in one of the Gospels, it says that John beckoned across to see or Peter beckoned across to John. So we're pretty well assured that Simon, who's the leader in training, who's made a wholesome series of mistakes along the way, he is still in training at the Last Supper as Jesus places him in the servant seat. And one of the things we know about the servant seat is that when there are no women present, and there are no women present because this is the Essene quarter, these are celibate people, the Essenes, that the servant seat is mandated to wash the feet of everyone else around the table. And when Jesus gets up, takes off his tunic, straps a towel around his waist, and begins to wash feet, who objects?
Peter.
Simon Peter. Why? Hmm. Because he failed to do it. So even at the Last Supper, our successor rabbi in training here messes up again. So freeze that thought. And in the midst of this upper room, Peter makes some pretty outstanding statements here. Let me go to John 13, where Jesus predicts his betrayal. And in John 13:37, Jesus says, "Where I am going, you cannot now follow, but you will follow later." And Peter says, "Lord, why can't I follow you now? I will lay my life down for you." Given to robust statements is this Peter. Then Jesus answered, "Will you really lay down your life for me? Verily, verily, I tell you," and now we've got some fascinating translational issues here, "before the rooster crows, you will disown me three times." Now, this is really a weak translation. It shows up in many translations, this phrase, "rooster crows." But the predecessor word that has preceded this in the translation is "cockcrow," which over time was separated between cock and crows, so that cockcrow became cock crows, and cock crows gets translated for us Westerners as rooster crows, but it misses the point. Because cockcrow is the sound emitted by the shofar horn that's blown from the southwest corner of the temple. And one would be blown at 3 a.m. to designate the end of the three-hour watch there from midnight to 3 a.m., okay? Now, they've left the, they're in the upper room setting. They're going to leave that by midnight, and they're going to start walking their way past the temple through the Kidron Valley to get to Gethsemane, all right? And so, this is what Jesus has said. By the time the shofar horn blows at 3 a.m., the blowing of cockcrow, you will have denied me three times. Okay? Pretty powerful, this cockcrow thing. Because it, well, we're getting ahead of ourselves here. So then Peter makes his denials three times in John 18, 15 and 25. So let's go over here back to John 18. Simon Peter and another disciple were following Jesus. Because this disciple was known to the high priest, he went with Jesus into the high priest courtyard. But Peter had to wait outside at the door. The other disciple who was known to the high priest came back, spoke to the servant girl on duty there, and brought Peter in. "You aren't one of this man's disciples, are you?" she asked Peter. "I am not," he replied. It was cold, and servants and officials stood around a fire they had made to keep him warm. Peter also was standing there with them, warming himself. Verse 25 in John 18. Meanwhile, Simon Peter was still standing there, warming himself. So they asked him, "You aren't one of his disciples, are you?" He denied it, saying, "I am not." And one of the high priest's servants, a relative of the man whose ear Peter had cut off back in Gethsemane, challenged him, "Didn't I see you with him in the garden?" And again, Peter denied it, and at that moment, cockcrow sounded. Now, because cockcrow is the sound emitted from the shofar horn at the temple, Peter is now reminded, made aware of the fact that he is unclean and he cannot worship. That's the power of the cockcrow, the sound from the shofar, which gets so much diluted in its import, in its weight, in its significance when it, we end up with rooster crows.
Well, if it's just a chicken, it means coincidence. If it's the shofar, Jesus knew this was going to, this was intended.
He's also saying, "You will deny me three times before 3 a.m. I mean, he is really specific on the timing here. So, our man, Peter, has blown it three times. He still is the successor rabbi to the band. But there is some remedial work that has to be done here in fairly short order. And that takes us to John 23. I'm sorry, John 21. Afterward, Jesus appeared to his disciples by the Sea of Galilee. This is where it all started. It happened this way. Simon Peter, Thomas, also known as Didymus, Nathanael from Galilee and Cana, the sons of Zebedee, and two other disciples were together. "I'm going out to fish," Simon Peter told them, and they said, "Well, we'll go with you." And so they went out and got into the boat, but that night they caught nothing. This is an action remez all the way back to their initial calling, when they did the same thing in Luke 5 and caught nothing. Early in the morning, Jesus stood on the shore, but the disciples did not realize that it was Jesus, and he called out to them, "Friends." Fascinating phrase, isn't it? Friends. "Haven't you any fish?" "Well, no," they answered him. Just like Luke 5. But now it changes. And Jesus said, "Throw your net on the right side of the boat and you will find some." When they did, they were unable to haul the net in because of the large number of fish. So a slight change in how you're supposed to manage your nets, but the outcome is the same as was in Luke 5, a large catch of fish. Then the disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, "It's the Lord." As soon as Simon Peter heard him say, "It is the Lord," he wrapped his outer garments around him, for he had taken it off, and jumped into the water. The other disciples followed in the boat, towing the full net of fish, for they were not far from shore, about 100 yards. When they landed, they saw a fire of burning coals there with fish on it and some bread. In the Old Testament way of understanding things, Jesus is going about to do what's known as the meal covenant here. He's going to have a meal with somebody, and that's a very highly significant action. Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish you have just caught." Jesus said to them, "Come and have breakfast." And none of the disciples dared ask him, "Who are you?" They knew it was the Lord. Jesus came, took the bread and gave it to them, and did the same with the fish. This was now the third time Jesus appeared to his disciples after he was raised from the dead. And now, in full public view of the other disciples, Jesus has to, I'll call it, reclaim Simon and get him back established in front of the other disciples, his restoration to be the legitimate leader of the band, now that Jesus is shortly to go to heaven. And when they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" "Yes, Lord," he said, "you know I love you." And Jesus said, "Then feed my lambs." Again, Jesus said, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" And the second response, "Yes, Lord, you know I love you." "Take care of my sheep then," said Jesus. The third time Jesus said to him, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" How many times has Jesus asked this question?
Three times.
Mm-hmm.
See any symmetry here?
I see symmetry.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Okay. Restoration is taking place. You denied me thrice. I'm going to restore you thrice.
Do you suppose Peter realized that at that point, that was what was happening? I know I'm supposing is a dangerous thing here, but
yeah, it's
such a structured and ritualized society. I mean, was he counting, do you suppose?
He may have. The Jewish mind is taught to keep the order and the sequence of what a rabbi says very clear in their mind, because the entire structure sometimes, the inverted symmetry of what's said is all part of the message. Certainly, The question is the same here, but the response is slightly different. It's, I'm going to paraphrase it here into English. It's, tend to my sheep, care for my lambs, feed my sheep. All different aspects of shepherding. Okay? Now, I'm going to make an observation here that's been very, very significant for me. That was given to me way, way, way back when I started teaching in 1980 or so. I was teaching graduate students at Michigan State University in the Gospel of John. I had a steering group of graduate students. And one of those was a man, young man named Bill Jakes. And when I took over this class, it had about 15 students in it. It rather quickly built up to 50 or 60. And then it plateaued. And being the businessman that I was then, you know, I'm always into growth. And if something plateaus, it must mean that something's wrong, that something's not going right, that something needs to be improved. And so when we stabilized at 50 or 60 graduate students for several months, I raised the question, why has the growth stopped? Do we need to consider doing something different? And Bill Jakes looked at me. He was a really sanguine young man. He said, you know, Doug, when I read the end of John, I find Jesus asking Peter three times, do you love me? And in response to Peter's answer in the affirmative, he says, tend for my sheep, care for my lambs, feed my sheep. But he never said, count them. And I have lived with that wise advice for a long, long time, because there are sometimes I will travel all the way across the country to speak to 30 people when I thought I was going to be speaking to 300. And I have had to learn, don't count them. Each sheep is precious to Jesus, and feed them, mm-hmm. care for them, tend to them. That's what your job description is. And I suspect in your ministry, from time to time, when you count the number of listeners, you may wonder, why am I doing what I'm doing? And perhaps this observation here will be of benefit to both of you as well. Jesus never said, count my sheep. He simply said, feed them, tend for them, and care for them.
Hmm. You know, a minute ago, you were talking about Jesus telling them from the shore, 100 yards away, to put the net on the other side of the boat, and then John recognized him. I've often wondered why they couldn't tell it was Jesus, and then all of a sudden they could. There was a piece of missing information there. Did they drift closer so they could see him and recognize him visually? Now I'm thinking, no. John recognized the remiss. He said, this is familiar. Wait a minute. It dawned on him what was happening.
Yeah, we're given an interesting piece of distance information here, 100 yards. That's 300 feet.
Mm-hmm. And it's there for a reason.
So if you're standing in one end zone on a football field, can you see clearly the features on the face of person standing at the end of the other football, the other end of the football field?
Not likely, no.
Yeah, so that may be part of the explanation. Also, Peter had to do some significant swimming here. The Sea of Galilee gets deep quickly. That's why they were catching large amounts of fish only 100 yards from shore. So there's an interval of time here where he's dog paddling or stroking or doing something mm-hmm. to get himself to the beach.
Interesting scene, but that idea that John may have recognized that it was Jesus by virtue of that command to drop the net on the other side of the boat, and he would have said, this happened before. That's powerful to me.
I think it's voice recognition.
Mm-hmm.
A, we're on water, so sounds travel over
water.
That's true.
Yeah.
And we've had that whole teaching from Jesus that my sheep recognize my voice.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so I suspect this was voice recognition.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's fascinating to see and hear and feel the context. It is so much more complex. And the seating around the table, it was another key point in my mind, to think that Peter had failed to wash the feet when that was his assigned task, being in that seat. And Jesus intervened And one, it's a magnificent lesson that the master himself would wash your feet. But it must have been a stinging rebuke to Peter, at least in his mind. At the same time, like he should have recognized that, oh, I missed my deal here. I am remiss.
Yeah, and there's a great amount of solace here, I think, for a follower of Jesus Christ, because we do mess up commission and omission, but it doesn't mean the master gives up on us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And as many times and as significantly and seriously that Peter messed up, he still was restored and still put in a position of leadership in the early church that we see in Acts.
We're talking with Doug Greenwald, Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director at Preserving Bible Times. Doug, how's enrollment going at the IBC seminar there, conference that you're having in June?
We got about 220 seats filled right now,
nice.
We think we may be closing in on 250 to 300 by the time the conference starts.
Okay.
Wow. We have people from 25 states, all around the periphery of the United States, state of Washington, Oregon, California, mm-hmm. Texas, Arizona, Louisiana, Florida, South Carolina, Maine, Connecticut. I mean, it's just amazing where people are coming from. Mm.
East Dakota.
Yeah, East Dakota should be in there, too.
Oh, 26 yeah. states. Mm-hmm. East states. Dakota.
Well, we haven't decided that we're a state yet, but that's close.
Well,
we could be.
We're a state of mind.
There you go. There you go.
We should have special seating from anyone from East Dakota.
If you'd like more information on the Institute for Biblical Context and the seminar coming up, a conference, it's in Michigan. It's June the 12th, 13th, and 14th. There's information for you at the Preserving Bible Times website. You can click there if you're listening to BrokenRoadRadio.com this morning, if that's where you find us, and click on that Preserving Bible Times icon there. It'll take you there. There's information at the top of the page, or you can go to, is it ibc.org?
No, I don't think that will work. You just have to Google Institute of Biblical Context, okay. And then all that right. will get you there.
Alrighty. Institute of Biblical Context, yeah. So it'd be well worth looking into, and time is short. You're going to have to get on the bandwagon there and enroll now while there's still some room. Doug,
there is a bank named IBC, so that's taken over.
The International Bank of...
International Bank of Commerce, something. I think.
Okay. All right. Well, that's not the place to go. That won't help you at all.
That's not it.
Doug, thanks so much. It was a meaningful morning. We learned stuff, and we always look forward to that when you're around. So, again, thank you. Have a great week.
You bet, guys. See you again, and bye-bye. Thank you. Shalom,
Shalom. Shalom, Doug.